Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today has been involved in the publishing industry one way or another for many years. He's been a bookseller, he's an editor, and now his debut novella has won him huge acclaim as a writer too. Max Porter, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Hello.
Hello. Now, anyone with half an eye on the literary world would have heard of your book, Grief is the Thing with Feathers. Part novella, part polyphonic fable, part essay on bereavement is how it's been described. It's been one of 2016's breakout publishing successes. Waterstone's Book of the Month, a bestseller in both hardback and paperback charts, winner of this year's International Dylan Thomas Prize, also a winner of the inaugural Books Are My Bag Award, and now you've been awarded the Sunday Times Peters, Fraser and Dunlop Young Writer of the Year Award for 2016. So for a man whose literary career started selling books as a temporary Christmas job, it's really been quite some journey.
Good research, that's true. Yeah, but it has been an amazing journey, and I pinch myself, but what's amazing is what hasn't changed. I still feel I'm doing the same thing I was doing 15 years ago, which is thinking about how to get books in people's hands and having good, interesting conversations with people every day about books and literature and why it matters.
Exactly. So, I mean, it didn't really come out of the blue. It had been gestating this particular book for a long time.
A long time. My whole life, really, I was thinking about this story and how to do it. But I didn't mean to do it. That's the nice thing about it. I wrote it privately and didn't think, because of what it was, that it would ever be published. So I was able to have as full a conversation I could possibly have with it, because I had no commercial or economic imperative in mind at all. I just wanted to do it and get it right for me. And in retrospect, those are perhaps the things that have meant it worked, if you see what I mean. My blindness to commercial things meant that I wrote the true thing, which has meant that it's interested people. So I couldn't have planned it. But in retrospect, looking back, I see some kind of continuum between what I was reading and what I was talking about and what I was thinking about and this book. Yeah.
Well, can we go right back to the beginning, even further back down that road? High Wycombe in 1981.
High Wycombe. Did you know there's a High Wycombe in Perth, in Australia?
I didn't.
Yeah, Google it says I was born in Perth, Australia.
Really?
Yeah, in that High Wycombe.
Well, in fact, you were born here in Britain in 1981. To literary parents?
Bookish parents. My stepdad was in advertising when I was a kid and is a bookish guy. Studied architecture and is generally kind of... We were dragged into London to go to museums, and actually my stepdad used to drag us into London to go and look at notable tube stations of the modernist era. My mum was bookish. She was a photographer. My grandparents were both art historians, so if there's a kind of bookish centre, it's them. They were very literary people. I got given books as a child every birthday and every Christmas. They actually sort of built a library for us over the years. So, you know, I would get Shakespeare, Greek myths, English fairy tales, Grimm. My grandpa was quite serious about that.
Grief is obviously central to the book, but it was also, in a way, central to your childhood.
Yeah, my dad died when I was six. And I have been preoccupied with it, with him. I miss him a great deal. And it informed the way I lived, perhaps more than it might otherwise have done had I not been kind of I was sort of romantic and sentimental about him. And my brother and I were very close, and our relationship was always sort of dancing around this central absence of my dad. And we thought a lot about it, and we sort of took it in turns to think differently about it. And I found growing up that there were things I didn't know and I wanted to know, and I couldn't quite commit to anything, to any type of self-expression, art or music or anything, without finding I was thinking about this central thing in my life, which was his absence. And then I found that the music and the art and the literature that I was attracted to tended to be quite bleak. I became quite death-obsessed. I think you do if you lose a parent. And you identify with other people who have also been grieving for a long time. It's almost like a club that you join. I have a friend who describes it as the Dead Dad Club, which it sounds crass, but in fact isn't. I think it's a way of people finding they have some common emotional ground. It was the big subject for me. Whether I've scratched that itch now with this book, I don't know whether it's still the big subject for me. But I think as a culture, we perhaps don't think about the dead quite right. And that was one of the reasons I wrote the book.
You talk about your brother and the way that you both together and separately tried to make sense of what had happened. But of course, in the book, the voice of the two children becomes one.
Yeah. that is and was my only real idea when I started. I wanted to write the sibling relationship as a character. I thought that would be a way of more truthfully getting to what the sibling relationship means. Because I think if you separate them and you label them and you name them and age them and put them into any kind of conventional chronology, they become peculiarly flat or conventional. They don't yield as much as I wanted them to yield as a thing. So when I made them one, like a sort of two-dimensional template, they became suddenly this extraordinary playground. You know, they were like a stage prop, the boys. And then I can wheel them on and off at different times and then fill them in kind of hyper-realistic detail within that simple template of them being boys. Mm. But what I wanted to get at is the way that you, when you're in a close relationship like that with a sibling, there is a gamesmanship involved, I think. There's a play with memory, with narrative, and especially when the narrative is that the architecture of your life has been violated, there's a space, there's a hole. How do you both work around that hole? So what does it mean, for example, as my brother and I were growing up, what does all sorts, actually, cultural and medicine and health and faith, all those things are sort of approached differently but together, if you see what I mean. You're in conversation. Like they say in the book, you know, we were in brother with each other. Mm. It's like a loving relationship, which has its pitfalls and it has its ups and downs. And sometimes it becomes aggressive. I mean, when we fell out quite nastily, but there was always this understanding that that was our right. That was our privilege. We were thrown into this closeness and we could therefore do whatever we wanted with it. And as it happens, we're very, very close and we've got good friends and we had children around about the same time. And I think we both had children, perhaps in a sense of unfinished business. We both wanted to carry on our dad's work. So we were completely shaped by it. And we've both ended up making this work that is about it, as if it was this question we needed to answer, like an itch that needed to be scratched.
Well, you got to this work via art, though, because you were studying the history of art.
Mm. I think of it as a collage, as a piece of... I don't think of it particularly in... I mean, I like that people think of it as a novel, and that's separately an interesting thing, to think about what the novel is and how it can be approached, or categorised or canonised or whatever it is people want to do in novels. But for me, it was an extension of collage making, of piecing together different things and building a shape. And particularly with the number three, with triptychs, it was an extension of my thinking I was doing long time ago as a teenager about triptychs and religious paintings and devotional objects. Particularly Francis Bacon's triptychs had a colossal impact on me as a teenager, thinking about how you can utilise the number three, how you can use three panels to disrupt or to present a story, i.e. the progression of a figure across space or a death from drugs, you know, any narrative, how you can, with the number three, how you can force your viewer in and out, mm-hmm. in a way you can't do in a single image. So those, as you say, they're aesthetic preoccupations. They were visual things.
You studied at the Courtauld?
I did. I did my BA and my MA there. BA not so happily, MA very happily. I loved my masters. It was me and nine mature students, all women, mostly not English. And we were doing psychoanalysis and feminism, and it was an incredible privilege to be in a room with these very, very clever people, all of whom had come at it from a different angle. You know, one of them was a specialist in African art of the 20th century, one of them was a specialist in Victorian watercolours, and we were all talking about the body politic and signs and symbols in art. It was an amazing way to spend a year. Mm. And what happened in that year for me was what you would hope would happen during the BA and didn't quite for me, is that I just completely fell in love with the library. I thought, God, what an amazing privilege it is to have access to all this. I read like a maniac in that year. And I think actually the depth of that year, how hard I went into that stuff, meant that when I sprung out at the end of it and went into a bookshop and said, give me a novel, and they gave me The Count of Monte Cristo, The Guy in Books, etc. Went, there you are, that's the novel. I think that I therefore was, it was like an atom bouncing. I mean, I bounced off art straight into literature and therefore went into my book-selling years with this absolute hunger for the novel. Mm. But always, I mean, I think art history, I thought about this a lot this year with the threat to those courses and the idea that art history might be scrapped except in private schools. It'd be just a disastrous thing, I think, culturally for us. But it led me to do a lot of thinking about why I loved art history so much, why I think it's such a good subject. And I think the answer in a nutshell is that it is all, if done well and taught well, it is all subjects. You can't look at art without politics, without anthropology, without social science, without geography. It's such an interesting way of looking at the world. And I still feel that's going to always be my deep pleasure.
Mm. And of course, as with any good MA, you were almost unemployable, which is why you,
Thank you very much.
ended up doing a variety of different casual jobs, one of which was in a bookshop.
Yeah, I did a lot of work in bars. I wouldn't want to write that out of my history. I think you must work in a bar. I'm going to get my children to work in bars. Because I think until you've seen how rude people can be to the person serving you, you don't grow the necessary skills of humility. I don't know. I think it's important. I used to serve wine at art private views and book launch and stuff. And that thing of someone just with their back turned to you holding out their glass for a refill. And you think, well, I've judged you. You're not a good person.
Selling books.
Selling books is just glorious. I mean, as I said, I'm still doing it. What I particularly loved and miss, actually, is the roll of the dice in a city like London, where the door will open and someone will come in, and it could be a lord buying coffee table books for their yacht, or it could be a builder who's only got $7.99 and really cares what book you recommend him, and he'll come back and tell you if that book's not right. That's such a privilege, because I love talking to people about books. So I just suddenly found that it was a really, really good job. Mm. And James Daunt, who owns Daunt's and now runs Waterstones, was a really lovely, I mean, infuriating, but lovely person to work for, because he's a proper bookseller. He understands that the spending of money on books, undiscounted, you know, full price books, is serious and important, and, you know, for all sorts of reasons to do with, you know, civilization, it's important. But it's also, you can't take it for granted. It's, you know, $7.99 is a lot of money to spend on a book. Are books good value? You know, we had these conversations, you know, what are we doing to make these books present? You know, should a bookshop be a nice environment? Should we be doing events? Should we be having accounts with schools? You know, we tried to keep it alive and independent and tried to resist the terrible pressures on bookshops. And it being in London meant that just the variety of people coming in and the quality of material we were selling was always incredible.
Mm.
And, I loved it.
And you crossed from there into making books, into editing books. You went to work for Granta.
Yes. In, I guess, about 5 years ago, yeah. And it was a really special thing, because I didn't think I would ever get a job. I was happy being a bookseller. Frustrated, perhaps, in ways, but happy.
And bookseller of the year, in fact.
I was young bookseller of the year. Thank you. I've still got my copper nib. Every time my wife tries to chuck it out, I have to say, no, it's a special thing, my copper nib. My rusty copper nib.
Which is not a euphemism.
No. What were we saying about bookselling?
So you went off to work for Granta, the literary magazine, where you're still an editor.
It was a dream. That was a dream, because I didn't think I had a CV and who would possibly employ me. And I was unemployable, I think, because my CV just said academia and then bookselling.
Mm.
And Granta took a punt on me at that time, because I think it was a time when, and particularly Philip Gwynne-Jones, who I knew because I'd sat on various kind of committees with him and done a lot of book launches for them and stuff, thought now is a time in publishing when actually booksellers are precisely the kind of people we need to get in, because we need to work out how to sell books again and how to hand sell books and how and what that operation of trust and curatorial skills and fundamental empathy with the consumer is needed in publishing, is lacking, severely lacking in some quarters in publishing. And then I discovered, thinking, God, they've taken this crazy punt. This could go terribly badly wrong, that actually I was quite good at it and I really liked it. And then I found out that lots of the great publishers were booksellers. Because if you've seen the end of the process, you quite quickly understand the beginnings of it.
Mm.
And then after about a year, I realised I was in my dream job, which has been a problem for me this year, because I don't want to leave it. I really, really enjoy doing it. It renews itself. You know, I'm living always a year and a half, 2 years ahead. So right now I'm in autumn 2018. I'm working on a book that people won't read for a long time, and I'm in a private conversation with authors, and it's like a soulmate relationship in someone's text with them, and it's a daily privilege.
So how did you manage with the whole genesis of your own book and keeping your job going? Where was there writing time? Because by that stage you were married and you had young children.
Yeah, I mean, there has never been writing time is the honest answer, and I think it's good for writers to talk about that you need a job. You can't live by writing. Not many people can. And so I like that there are writers that say, I walked on the beaches of Connecticut for 6 months looking at birds and then the great American novel sprung forth. That's fine, each to their own. But I was utterly in the commuting domestic realm, and it was beautiful. And all I did was just fought for time. So firstly, I wrote the book on my Gmails. I sent myself chunks of the book back and forth on Gmail. And it was almost, the whole of it was done like that. And then I took it off and borrowed a laptop that had Microsoft Word and put it in. And then I would write in the evenings. I'd put my kids to bed and write late.
I think it's time now for us to address exactly what the book is, because I'm not sure how to describe it. I mean, prose, poetry, polyphonic fable, those are all words that are thrown around. Novella. What is your book?
I love polyphonic fable. I'm really happy with that. Faber called it that, and I felt it had been named when they said that. That felt right, because I'm so in love with the fables and the fairy tales and myth, and the polyphonic thing was exactly what I, without realising it, had wanted it to be. Somewhere in between a play for voices and a fairy tale is just right for me. Mm. And I mean, novella is about right. They've got to call it something. And I understand that bookshops need labels. I like that it hops around in bookshops. I find it in different sections in bookshops. And I like that.
Do you always do the authorial thing of moving it so it's absolutely at the front of the shelf?
No, I don't touch it.
Wouldn't
and
dream
I'm
of it.
I'm so bashful. I say things like, I wonder, you know, early on, I say, I wonder if you've, I don't know, no problem if you haven't. I just, you know, wonder if you've got, and they'd like, turn around and there'd be a massive wall of it. You know.
Fantastic. Of course, we can't talk about the book without talking about Ted Hughes, who is a massive influence on both the book and, I gather, on you too. So tell me about your relationship with Hughes.
Well, I never met him because I died when I was a child. I always read him. I mean, I read the children's books were read to me, and the children's poetry was read to me, and The Iron Man and The Iron Giant, and I read his poetry as a teenager. I read Crow and was profoundly affected by Crow. And then I didn't think much about Hughes, and I fell in love with other types of poetry and sort of became a poetry fan, a poetry nerd. And then I started to get obsessed with the possibility of releasing Ted Hughes from the biographical prison that he had been in. And I recognised that that happened to coincide with that effort more widely in this country, that people have been reassessing Ted Hughes and trying to set aside the Hughes-Plath mythology and reassess the poems. And the publication of his letters was a big moment in that, which is, if listeners haven't read The Letters of Ted Hughes, I think it's one of his great books. It's an astonishingly good book and an incredible insight into a giant mind, a giant figure in the history of this country. And so then I sort of thought, well, what would it be, when I had this idea for this book, I thought, what would it be like if I give this man an obsession with these poems, particularly the Crow poems, and if that obsession comes alive? And then I thought, well, the crow can't be Hughes's Crow. He's got to be all the Crows, and he's got to have some kind of critical distance from this book. It's got to be a loving homage, but therefore he's going to have to be critical. It's got to be a critical homage. And how to do that? I'll make the dad this sort of shambolic scholar of the Crow poems, and therefore I can say some of the things I want to say about that, the biographical tyranny of the Hughes-Plath thing.
Because, of course, Plath had just committed suicide at the time of Crow.
Yeah, Crow poems were written after that and just before the death of Assia Wevil. So what I wanted to do basically was write all around that, all about that, but never really name it. You know, reviewers struggled with that early on. I'd read reviews that would be banging on about the death of Sylvia Plath and suicide literature and Assia Wevil, and I think, oh, that's, you missed it. What, you're not mentioning the boys, you're not mentioning this man, you're not mentioning anything to do with the reader of these poems. The point is that every reader, the poems live again in these readers, and it's your choice as a reader to dismantle them or vandalise them, or reanimate them, or misunderstand them, or understand them, or share them with your children, or whatever it is you want to do. And the problem with the canon, with the biography, is that the poems are always so damagingly linked to the life. And I think there has to come an effort on each of our parts to separate them, whilst also not kidding ourselves. Those Crow poems take a huge, you know, much of their energy is from what we know about the circumstances of their writing. So in that respect, it's my kind of, My humble contribution to Hughes scholarship, in a way, is this consideration of the possibility of moving on and the consideration of the character coming back. I mean, it started, as he says in the book, as my original idea was that Crow himself would annotate the Crow poems. So a bit like Don Quixote coming back and going through that book and saying, well, that wasn't me, or he made that up, or, well, you've got to bear in mind that that was happening while we were all being hung for believing in that god, or whatever, you know, so that the whole text becomes annotated with the circumstances of its creation and stuff like that. And I knew that Faber would never give me permission to do that, so this was the result.
I mean, there's hope in it too, as in fact the original Emily Dickinson quote from which the title is taken says.
Hope is the thing with feathers. What I'm simply suggesting is that what Dickinson said about hope, I believe is the case with grief, that you can, that it nestles in the soul and that it grows with us and that it can be extraordinarily generative, that grief can shift and change and be ecstatic and beautiful, and that it's something we keep on needing to address and needing to be a part of us. And it was also a quick way of me paying my respects to, the, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest thinker of these things, which is Dickinson. I think if you're interested in language and poetry and the possibility of language to address infinity and pain and faith and the void, then all roads lead to Dickinson. I think she's the greatest. And as it happens, Hughes felt the same and so did Plath, and therefore there's this whole triangular relationship going on between these poets that I've loved.
And there you have that three again, and of course the book in these three voices, in Crow, in The Father, and then in the boys, plural. It wasn't always a book, though. It started off, as you were talking about it, as a sort of collage. You experimented with a graphic novel, too.
Yeah, I found that I couldn't draw well enough. My draftsmanship isn't good enough to express myself. And I have also tried prose, and my prose isn't quite good enough. Only in this kind of hybrid form did I feel that I was getting close to what I wanted to say, or to the music that I wanted to make, the kind of energy of it. That may be just time. It may be that I need to work harder at both those things. You know, I always felt, again, this triangular tension of growing up between music and art and painting. And I thought when I was doing one, I missed the other. And so in a way, this is the result of that tension, that it's more mixtape or collage or stew than it is polished piece of literature. We're all doing that. We're all trying to find the right form for what we want to say. And I have to accept now with some clarity about the way this came together, looking back, that various things clicked into place in quite a lucky way for me personally in the writing of it. You know, the number three, but also my obsession with birds and crows and my slight anger or my slight dissatisfaction with some of the novels I've grown up around or see out now that seem to sort of rest on a set of quite dull conventions and don't seem to be working hard enough to actually get at the heart of the matter. And so it just... You know, I wonder if I had made other decisions. You know, for example, there was a point when this book was not going to have a crow and it was going to have Telemachus in it from the Odyssey. And it was going to be a book about waiting. He was going to move in with these children and teach them about waiting for their dad to come back and about the impossibility of dads ever coming back, really. And I think, gosh, then I would have missed out on the whole fun of the project, which was making a bird-like book. I wanted to make a book that moves like a bird. And you know, that's the thing I'm probably... the only thing, really, I'm proud of with it is that I think it's crow-like, and I look at crows now and I feel that they're my friends, and I've looked at them for so long and so hard that I wrote them a book. You know, that's my little gift to
absolutely
crows.
It flutters, it soars, it pecks. Yeah. It's a fabulous piece of work.
I put my claw on his eyeball and weighed up gouging it out for fun or mercy. I plucked one jet feather from my hood and left it on his forehead for his head. For a souvenir, for a warning, for a lick of night in the morning, for a little break in the morning. I will give you something to think about, I whispered. He woke up and didn't see me against the blackness of his trauma. Go easy, he clacked. Go easy.
Was Faber always the place where you were going to take it? I mean, I know you wrote it without publication particularly in mind, but once it went to that point, it would seem, I suppose, only natural to go to Hughes' publisher.
It was like a sort of pure sexual release that I didn't dare think about until I thought about it, if you see what I mean. I finished it and it was book-shaped and I felt it was a book and I wanted to share it with people, and I showed it to my wife. And she said, I don't know what you'll do with that. And I showed it to my friend who works in publishing, and she said, oh, I don't know what you'll do with that, but you should do something with it. And then I thought, well, why not? There's this sort of magical feeling in my head that possibly Faber should do it. And if they don't want to do it, they'll shut it down. You know, that someone at Faber will say, dream on, kid. You're not putting out a book about, you know, Hughes's crow coming alive. And then I started to sort of fantasize in the weeks when I had sent it to Hannah Griffiths at Faber and her writing back to me. It was a few weeks and I was all skittish. And in that time, I thought, God, if she likes it and they do it, they could use Bertold Wolper's font and it could look like a love letter. It could, all the things within it that, as far as I'm concerned, little patterning things, little secret things in there about the way I've read those books and the way those books have been a part of me, they could become subtly visual. They could, you know, it could start to speak backwards. And then it happened in a dream, like it just happened. It was incredible.
How has it changed you as an editor now, being a published writer? Has it changed the way that you deal with your authors in any way?
Practically it has, because I'm a little slower on the emails. I pride myself on being a very responsive editor, and I have just been incredibly busy. I think I'm much more... I mean, as I say, the whole game for me is empathy. That's what we all should be working harder at. And I now empathise much better with writers. I've gone mad this year. It makes you go mad. And I knew that before, but I wasn't especially understanding of it. And I now really do understand. The whole mania of staying up and reading your Amazon reviews and being so crazily hurt by criticism, by some guy on a blog somewhere saying, oh, it's shit, is devastating. And I know the lines I would have trotted out for my writers, like, oh, for God's sake, you know, you won the Guardian Prize. You don't need to worry about what some guy on a blog says, and, you know. But of course you do worry, and I'm now better, and I listen to that better, I think. Mm. And I start earlier on the sort of shoring up of my author's belief in their work and the kind of endless building for my authors a kind of world of context and confidence that they can live in. Because the publishing of a book is exposing and frightening, and I want them to feel safe and secure, and that the decisions we made, we didn't make them lightly. From the tiniest movement of words around on the page to the cover of the book and the format of the book and where we have the launch party and all those things, I want them to feel like they can never regret the discussions they had because they were good discussions. Mm. So the discursive element has been important for me. I think I'm also a little bit more... I guess I've learned to take it a bit easier. Because, you know, have you ever read Step by Diana Rathill? Mm-hmm. She says a brilliant thing in that about, you know, which is the Bible if you're an editor. She says a brilliant thing about, you know, nothing will happen between Friday and Monday in publishing. The world won't end. It's publishing. We're just making books. And I needed to be reminded of that. And this book has reminded me of that. That the whole checking of my emails at 3 a.m. is a madness. I'll go mad. And no one needs a mad editor. They want a steady editor. And so now I've got this double life where I'm the invisible editor. I love being invisible. And I felt so overexposed, and yet I have to accept that I've enjoyed, you know, I like sitting on stage in front of a load of people talking about Emily Dickinson. It's really great. It's an honour. But I also love withdrawing back into the shadows and thinking about someone else's book and not trying to make that book more myself or more my, but nothing to do with me, making it more their own book. And it's been a terrific distraction. For the times when I could be going mad checking my Amazon rankings, I'm busy in you know, Sarah Moss's wonderful new book about the building of Coventry Cathedral. I'm a million miles away from Ted Hughes and from questions about her. I'm just working with a brilliant, extraordinary novelist on her book, and that's really good.
What about yours, your next book?
Nothing. I just don't have any time. I've accepted a couple of little collaborative things. People have written to me and asked me to do stuff, and I'm going to do some stuff. And there is a big book in my head that wants to be written, and every time I carve out some time to sit with it, the voices are still too loud in my head. The voices of those bloggers and those early reviewers, and I just think, why force myself to do this? I don't need to. I don't believe in publishing for the sake of it, you know. And publishers are terrible, imitative people. You know, they see a success and they quickly want it. You know, the number of books I'm getting now saying for fans of Grief is Doing Feds, and I think, well, that's not how it works. You can't predict this. This was an unpublishable 8 pages of A4 paper that, for various reasons of good publishing and luck and timing, perhaps, has flown off in pleasing directions. But you can't copy. You have to just make the work you've got to make, and I'm not ready to make any more work yet.
Well,
also, someone's making a play. And I really am excited about that. And I want to just have the time to talk to them, and they want me to be involved, and that will be really wonderful.
Max Porter, we are all holding our breaths. Thank you so much for coming
on. Thank you.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks very much to my guest today, who is Max Porter. His book is Grief is the Thing with Feathers. It's published by Faber and Faber, and it's out now. Thanks very much to producer Claire Urban. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.